I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There may be no more controversial point of debate in this so-called war on terror than the holding ground for those who are accused of waging it. The U.S. Military Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay has drawn the unusual public criticism of the International Committee of the Red Cross. It has been questioned by the American Bar Association, and most recently it has prompted the disdain of a senior British judge, Lord Steyne, who said, quote, "As a lawyer brought up to admire the ideals of American democracy and justice, I would have to say that I regard this as a monstrous failure of justice." The latest news in a feature piece in Time magazine says over 100 of the Guantanamo Bay prisoners are expected to be released within the next month or so. There are also negotiations underway with the British and the Australians to have prisoners transferred out of the facility in Cuba. But it remains one of the most controversial features of Bush's war on terror. So, what do you think about the prisoners at Guantanamo? Or do you think about them at all? Is Guantanamo Bay a new and appropriate response to a new kind of conflict? Or is it a stain on the history of American justice? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll be hearing two expert opinions on the legal and moral questions over Guantanamo in a couple of moments. First, though, a look inside. Vivica Novak is a reporter with Time magazine who helped write this week's feature called Inside the Wire, and she's joining us from a studio in Washington. Hi, Vivica.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm well. I gather it is just about as hard to get into Guantanamo Bay as it's meant to be hard to get out.
It's not easy to get there. You have to go through the military, of course, and you have to be escorted down there from Jacksonville, Florida. And you are basically accompanied every step of the way once you're there. You also have to stay the better part of a week because there are limited numbers of flights out. And they really, you know, they have a tour that they have things that they want you to see. They want you to see that it's not so bad down there, either for the troops or for the detainees. So you have to kind of hew to their schedule.
Well, how close do you get to the detainees themselves?
Well, you get very close. I mean, we got to go inside a vacant cell block and see vacant cells, but the detainees are not far away. Occasionally, you can glimpse a detainee. We did not get to do that as much as some reporters who go down there at different times have the opportunity to do because it was Ramadan, so they weren't coming outside for lunch. I got a fair view of what it's like down there.
And I gather that a lot of journalists have been through, and many of them from foreign countries.
Yes, there's a high degree of interest from foreign journalists. And in fact, while I was there, they were just considering a request from Al Jazeera to come over. And presumably they were going to allow them there as long as they abided by the rules everyone else has to abide by.
Vivica, one of the things that struck me about the piece that you and the others wrote in this week's edition of Time is just how dug in it seems that the American military and the civilians who run the facility at Guantanamo Bay are. I mean, it really sounds like it's developing into a small town.
Well, it's interesting because right before 9/11, Guantanamo Bay had been kind of downsized and was operating under what they call caretaker status, so that there were only a few hundred troops there. There were some civilians. The total population was about 2,000. Then they decided to use it for this purpose for people captured abroad in the war on terrorism, and they began ramping up so that now there's between 6,000 and 7,000 troops and civilians there. And a lot of the buildings that had been slated to be torn down are instead being refurbished and revamped. And there are new things being built. There's all kinds of, new amenities, new gyms. There's a four-year college that's scheduled to open in January. Everything is being made more pleasant for the troops. Plus, there are all these new security features, these fearsome new road barriers on the road to Camp Delta, which cost quite a bit of money to build. And they're building an actual hard-walled prison facility where interrogations are going to take place. Right now, they take place in these old trailers. So everything looks as though it's being hardened and made permanent, which is a very interesting commentary on what we expect there.
So when you ask why, are they saying because they expect the 600 or so odd people who are there now to be there for a lot longer period of time, or because they are expecting to have many more people come through the facility?
Well, I guess what they are expecting is that the war on terror is not going to be over quickly. And yes, new people do come in. About 20 new detainees came in the weekend right after I left, which was a week ago. And it was, they do let people out. They're scheduled to let a lot of people out fairly shortly. But I think there are some people who are going to be there indefinitely, and I think they do expect some new people to come in.
Now, you mentioned that they're building a new interrogation center there. What do we know about what goes on inside the interrogation center?
Well, the interrogations, it's kind of interesting. I learned that there are about 40 interrogation teams, and they're called Tiger Teams. They're made up of four people, which include two interrogators from two different agencies, and an analyst and a linguist. And they work, they have interrogation teams going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the interrogations, I'm told, can last anywhere from an hour to 16 hours. And they also say that up to half of the detainees are questioned every week. I think the idea is for the interrogators to build relationships with the people they are questioning and to come at them again and again, sometimes with new information that we have gathered from our intelligence collection abroad, from prisoners that other nations are holding, from documents we're going through that we've seized. And we run things by them. We run names by them. We run, you know, other bits of information we've gotten by these people to see if we can fill out our knowledge of the war on terror.
See, that's a part of the whole story which I've never really understood. If some of those people, and I gather many of them, have been there for close to, if not over, 2 years now, I would have thought that all the information they were going to get from those people, they'd already got from those people.
Yeah, I think that there are a number of people that they have pretty well exhausted in terms of gathering useful information. As I said, from time to time, they could do something like run a new name by these people to see if they've ever heard of them or were they in the camps at the time they were or whatever. But I do think that the well is dry with a number of these detainees.
And are those the ones who we're expecting to see released later on this month?
Well, they won't give me specifics, but I would imagine that they are, if they're not considered dangerous at this point, that indeed the people who are not that useful anymore and perhaps never really were all that useful because they were swept up, perhaps not to the degree that they were not of the high danger and intelligence value that some of the others were. And we've discovered that. Now, it's taken extraordinarily long for us to process some of these detainees. And it's our understanding that when the Supreme Court announced this fall that it would hear a case involving whether the detainees can challenge their captivity in federal court, that sort of speeded up the processing. It kind of lit a fire under the Pentagon.
And is there any of that fire being lit by the ongoing criticism that keeps coming up either in the United States or overseas? Were you aware when you were there, Vivica, that people are in any way paying attention to this as something that's controversial?
Well, the people in the Public Affairs Office are very sensitive to it, which is one of the reasons that they want to show us that things aren't as bad as perhaps they're portrayed. For instance, you see, photographs over and over again of Camp X-Ray, which is the first camp that the detainees were brought to, which was basically, it reminded me of a trip to the animal shelter. I mean, the pens, you could call them, are just, regular wire, sort of fencing wire, and very exposed to the elements. Now it's abandoned, and you have vines curling all through it and vultures circling overhead, and it looks like it hasn't been used in 10 years.
But those are the same pictures that the television networks still use of the people
being frog-marched
around in the roaring suits.
And the military is its own worst enemy in this regard because they're not allowing pictures to be taken inside the new facilities. They show them to us, but they won't let pictures be taken. So news outlets wind up using the old pictures, which perpetuates the old image.
Vivica, thanks so much for coming in to give us your insights into that place.
It's great to be with you.
Vivica Novak is a correspondent with Time magazine. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll be taking your calls in just a few moments as we discuss what's going on at Guantanamo Bay, with news out just this week that over 100 people are expected to be released shortly from there. A chance, though, for me to introduce the two guests who will be with us for the balance of the hour. Ruth Wedgwood is joining us on the phone. She's a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins School of International Studies in Washington, D.C., and an advisor to the Pentagon. She's been on the program before. Ruth, nice to have you back.
Thank you.
I gather you have a cold.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. I've got a bossy voice this morning.
Joining me in our Boston studio is Jacqueline Baba. She teaches human rights at both Harvard Law School and Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She's also returning to the program. Jacqueline, it's nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Ruth, let me start with you, because you are writing an op-ed piece in this morning's edition of the International Herald Tribune, and the title is "Let Military Rules Apply While the War Goes On." Are you getting a little tired of all this hand-wringing over Guantanamo?
Actually, the title I wanted, which they didn't run, was "Lords on the Loose," which was a reference to Lord Steyn, who was, I thought, really over the top in a kind of a wildly conclusory lecture he gave.
What was wrong with that?
What was wrong with it?
Yeah.
Oh, there were a few little factual things wrong with it. He had one line, for example, that there was simply no rules for any war crimes trials that might ever be conducted. He'd referenced Ronald Dworkin. He'd referenced a number of journalistic pieces. He'd never bothered to actually look on the web at the rules that had been published by the Pentagon after having been scrubbed by a good number of American notables, including Bill Coleman, former Transportation Secretary of President Ford, and Bernie Meltzer, who was a Nuremberg prosecutor now teaching at
Okay, I quoted him at the open of the piece, talking about, using his words, as this as a monstrous failure of justice. Mm-hmm. Do you think he's just completely off base, out of line?
I think Lord Steyn, to be really very crude about it, if I may be forgiven on radio, may be trying to influence his government in its negotiations with the U.S. over the trial procedures for British prisoners at Guantanamo. And I don't myself think that's an appropriate role for a judge to be taking. But I think also, whatever his role in life, he is simply factually in an alternative universe.
Jacqueline Baba, you have had a chance to read the reporting of Lord Steyn's original remarks and seen some of his writing. What do you think of his attitude here about Guantanamo Bay?
I think he reflects the feeling of many, many people, both legally qualified and otherwise, in Europe. And I don't think that his comments are to be interpreted simply as influencing the government. Whether they do or not is quite a separate matter. I think he speaks quite genuinely and reflects a very widely held set of opinions. And I think what he says stands up absolutely. He criticizes the U.S. government for denying very, very basic rights to the detainees, for holding people for 2 years in a legal limbo in a situation where they have absolutely no access to their lawyers. They have no sense of why they're being held. They have no mechanism for challenging their detention, and they have no idea how long they're going to be there. These are extraordinary circumstances, and I think it's actually surprising that Ruth considers this to be a political ploy. It's not only the a senior judge from the House of Lords in Britain who's come out against this. It's also the International Committee of the Red Cross, as you said in opening.
I have to stop you. We have to take a short break, but Connection listeners, you're getting a sense that here on the program today, two different perspectives of Guantanamo Bay. We know you share different points of view about it as well, and we'd like to have you with us on the program. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Sometime later this month, over 100 of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay are slated for release, but that will leave over 500 still at a prison facility, which we heard earlier in the program is being developed into something quite permanent. So how are we to understand the place of that facility in American jurisprudence, in international law? Certainly the people who are responsible for holding the people there have no qualms about defending it as an important feature of fighting the war on terror. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, Jacqueline Baba. She's a director, she is director of Harvard University Committee on Human Rights and a lecturer at Harvard Law School and at the J.F. Kennedy School of Government, and a specialist in human rights. Ruth Wedgwood is joining us. She's a professor of international law and diplomacy at the Johns Hopkins School of International Studies. And Ruth, one of the things that comes up time and time again here is whatever happened to the Geneva Conventions, don't even the basic principles of the Geneva Conventions apply to people like this? What's your argument on the other side?
Well, actually, I will join your side. The basic principles of the Geneva Conventions do apply to people like this. I mean, perhaps not every jot and tittle of a third Geneva Convention designed for a different kind of war, but the basic principles of Geneva do apply. And although it's something that people, I think, prefer not to recognize, Geneva permits, endorses, allows countries to hold battlefield combatants for the duration of the conflict. It's expected. In fact, it was originally kind of the mirror face of the duty upon a belligerent to accept the surrender of the other side. In the bad old days, people got shot on the battlefield. Now you have to take their surrender, save their life, but you are also permitted to keep them from returning to the fight by interning them humanely for the duration of the war.
Don't those same conventions, though, also guarantee the people being held freedom from the sort of interrogation that's taking place at Guantanamo?
No, the Geneva Conventions permit the other side to interview the adversary to collect military intelligence information. Third Geneva has some language that may or may not be applicable. You can't do anything that's unequal, for example, under Third Geneva. You couldn't give a benefit to somebody who was cooperating. That could be troublesome language. But the basic principle that you are permitted to interview people to see what you can collect without giving Miranda warnings is one that Geneva respects. It's in the commentary. It is simply assumed. The movie version that you only have to give your name, rank, and serial number is correct in the sense that that's all you have to give. But they can ask you to give more. And in the case of Al-Qaeda and Taliban, one of the difficulties that the government faces is that typically the people don't give their name, rank, and serial number straight away. So you don't know who they are. And the very perfidiousness of guerrilla terrorist warfare is that they can use the pose of civilians when, in fact, they are very dedicated operatives.
Jacqueline, brand new war, brand new rules, and that these rules are being written right now. What do you make of that?
I think this is probably one of the most troubling aspects of the Bush administration's position on Guantanamo, the idea that you can rewrite international law that has been used by the U.S., amongst others, to defend its own military and its own troops abroad for decades. I think that it's quite clear that the administration is trying to have it both ways. Either these detainees are combatants, in which case they are covered by the Third Geneva Convention because they are prisoners of war, or they are non-combatants, in which case they are entitled to be tried as suspected criminals, terrorists, if you like. But to call them unlawful combatants is trying to, you know, have your cake and eat it. One of the main criticisms, I think, that is made of this current situation is that the Third Geneva Convention explicitly permits detainees to challenge their detention if they say they should not be held. If, for example, they say they were not combatants, but they happened to be on the battlefield, for example, doing humanitarian work, as some of the Kuwaiti detainees alleged. Article 5 of the Geneva Convention is absolutely clear on this, and there's no question that this is a different kind of war to which the Geneva Convention doesn't apply. If these are detainees held as prisoners of war, that article should apply. And
If the Geneva Conventions, as we understand them, were rules that were written after the Second World War because there were abuses or problems or issues that needed to be resolved in that conflict with which were not, is it not also reasonable, as I think Ruth would agree, to say that this is a new type of combat and the rules are being written now and will be codified only after the war on terror is understood to be what it is?
One of the most important aspects of international law is that you don't retrospectively change the law. That was one of the big criticisms of the Nuremberg situation, that it's argued that people were convicted under laws that didn't apply at the time that they committed the horrendous offences that they did commit. And I think it's very dangerous to make up the rules as you go along, particularly if you're making them up in the face of just about unanimous international criticism. We are here talking about international law and not domestic law. Imagine how the U.S. would react if the Iraqis, when they exhibited those photographs of the American soldiers who were captured very early on, had said, well, this is a different type of situation. This is, you know, this is an aggressive war by the U.S., and so we don't think that the Geneva Convention applies. Imagine what an outrage that would have created. So I think it's really important important to establish that if there are international rules, which the international community has accepted for the last 50 years, you don't rewrite them at a time when the issues are most relevant.
All right. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Alan. Alan's in Cambridge. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Yes. How are you? I have several points to make here. Number one, your guest is saying we're making up the rules as we go along. In fact, the combatants, or unlawful combatants, which I generally call them, break the rules as they go along. These people are women and children killers. They will go out and kill women and children first, every time. These people are the most depraved people on the planet Earth right now, and I think they should be tried and shot, in my opinion. One should
just
be
released. Hold on, Alan. Take a breath there. I'm going to let Jacqueline just respond to that so we don't get this great, great big pileup. He's got a point. These are not soldiers shooting soldiers. These, if they are, in fact, members of al-Qaeda, and that, I guess, is a question mark, these are people who target civilians and continue to.
2 points. Firstly, we don't know because we've not tested the evidence. There are amongst the detainees 13-year-old boys. Now, to call a 13-year-old boy one amongst the most dangerous people on the planet, I think, is pushing it. We have read in the papers that they have recently released people aged 60 and 70. Same issue. I'm not sure how dangerous those people are. And as I've already said, there is a real issue about some of the detainees. Now, that's the first point. So we don't know that all of these people are indeed so dangerous. Second point, if indeed we have evidence that these people are as dangerous and as pernicious as the caller alleges, why not bring them to court? Why not charge them? We've had nearly 2 years of having them in custody. I mean, either there is the evidence or there isn't the evidence. And as you yourself said, if there isn't the evidence now, it's unlikely to come. I mean, are they going to keep them for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years?
So, Ruth, why not take them to court?
Well, I'm not sure if Jacqueline's ever tried criminal cases. One of the problems in criminal cases is that, number one, in ordinary court, only a very narrow range of evidence and information is admissible. Number two, people don't like others who have informed on them. If what we know about detainee X comes from detainee Y, and we tell this fact to detainee X and to the public at large and to al-Qaeda because they read the news, then detainee Y's family may be killed in Pakistan or Afghanistan. It's a very nasty world out there. And one thing that prosecutors above all are cognizant of is their ethical obligation to protect people who have helped them.
But these folks aren't even being taken to the military tribunal.
No, but my point is that if what Jacqueline wants to have is a C-SPAN broadcast of Article 5 hearings, which were never designed to have lawyers, but never mind, so that the public at large, Al Jazeera, can broadcast how we know that a particular man is not a shepherd, but rather, say, a financial bagman for bin Laden or whatever you might want to suppose, that will pose great danger to the people who have informed against that detainee.
Just 2 points in reply. Firstly, it's long been established that to convict somebody of a criminal offense, you do have to prove your case.
This is not and criminal. We're talking identity hearings here.
No, well, if we're talking, I'm talking about bringing people to court who are charged with these terrorist acts, who are supposedly so dangerous. I'm saying if there is the evidence, charge them, treat them as criminals, number one. And number two, there are, of course, are ways of keeping certain information from being on C-SPAN.
No, there's not. Not an
there
ordinary
are.
Court.
Well, you don't need to have an ordinary court.
Oh, I enjoy that concession.
No, well, you can enjoy it. But the fact is, in the UK, for example, as you, I'm sure, know, there are these so-called Special Immigration Appeal Commissions, SIACs, which are precisely hearing cases, but where the evidence is only shown to particular lawyers. And
I'm
the
sure
evidence
you don't
is not made.
Well,
I think this is certainly an improvement on what's happening here. I think the situation where you just keep people indefinitely, they have no access to their lawyers for indefinite period of time, is completely unacceptable and flies in the face of anything that we consider to be justice.
1-800-423-8255. Alan, thanks for that call. Next to Heidi, who's joining us now from Boston. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. First of all, I'm delighted that you're doing a program on this. I think one of the greatest problems to date has been that the U.S. national media coverage has been lacking. And personally, I think if more people knew what was really going on in Guantanamo, more people would be on Jacqueline's side than on Ruth's side. This is very hypocritical, what the U.S. is doing.
Why is it hypocritical? Why isn't it new war, new rules?
Well, because they're really making things up as they're going along, or actually better, they're just ignoring all the rules that exist. They're they're selectively interpreting the Geneva Conventions. Moreover, my special interest has been the children that have been held in Guantanamo, and that very few people even know that there are children being held there, and that ironically, one of the few instruments, human rights instruments, that the U.S. has actually ratified is the optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child dealing with children in armed conflict.
You have some expertise here, Heidi.
Well, yes, actually, I do. I'm a physician, but I'm currently at the Boston School of Public Health doing a master's in health law, and I've actually done a research paper on the children in Guantanamo.
So, Ruth, why is it that the 13- and 14-year-old children deserve the same treatment? I'm assuming that you suggest that they are.
It's an awful situation to have child soldiers. I used to give advice to Laura Otunu, who was the special rep of the Secretary General on child soldiers. You know, it was a phenomenon you saw a lot of in West Africa, where the rough, for example, Fode Sanko's West Side Boys would recruit 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds to become militiamen who were engaged in some of the maiming with machetes, chopping off hands and legs. And the desire, of course, is to get those kids back to being kids instead of turning them into killers. The difficulty with the three kids that they picked up here, I think they were 13, 14, and 16, something like that, is that one of them had, in fact, thrown a grenade that killed a soldier. And we don't want to think of a kid as a combatant, but if, in fact, they've been inculcated into combatant activities, from the point of view of self-protection, they are combatants. They're being held separately, given educational programs. The guards who are involved with them are reservists who've had backgrounds either as teachers or probation officers. They're being given special entertainment. And from what I know, the Pentagon is trying as quickly as it can to get them repatriated to situations where they would not be lured back into this same kind of life, which was destroying their lives and destroying other people's lives.
Heidi?
Several comments. One is, according to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the definition of a child is anyone under 18. And that means that, as far as I know, there are up to 7 that fulfill that criteria as being a child. Only the ones under 15 are being held separately. The 16, and I think there are probably about 3 or 4 others who are under 18 are being held with the adults, which itself poses a whole other problem. UNICEF has a specific program for repatriating child soldiers. So nobody is saying you should just let them go. We're saying, for instance, hand them over to UNICEF, let them be repatriated. Even the commander at Guantanamo in August, back in August, said these kids should be released. They're of no more quote-unquote value, if that's what they were supposed to be in the first place. And his report is collecting dust in the Pentagon. I mean, why are these children still being held? It's outrageous.
I guess, Jacqueline, it is in part, and you've alluded to this already, that because they don't have the rules, it's better to just leave things the way they are rather than move quickly to shift the children to UNICEF, or because they're not really sure, you know, whether or not a move that they make at Guantanamo Bay is then going to be some part of international law.
I suppose the worry is that they think that they have an all or nothing situation. Either you keep them,
right,
or they're out in the world, you know, committing other offenses. But of course, there are other intermediary steps that could be taken. So you can repatriate them to their country, to, you know, to hand them over to the powers that be, to question them, to establish whether or not there are any criminal offenses that they're guilty of. I mean, I just did a quick calculation while your first speaker from Time magazine was talking. If indeed they have questioned half the detainees every week since they've had them, some of these people, including the children, because the children are also being questioned, have been questioned over 50 times. And, you know, it's not disputed that the interrogations last up to 16 hours, including for the children. Now, if this isn't close to torture, I don't know what is. This is completely unacceptable behavior. I mean, just think of what, I don't know if you have any children. I have a 15-year-old. If I think of a 13-year-old, 2 years younger than my daughter, being detained for 2 years, far away from home, being questioned every other week for up to 16 hours. It's unbelievable. With what authority can we criticize other regimes for being barbaric if this is what we do in our advanced democracies? I agree with the call. I think this is really an outrage.
Ruth?
Well, it's hard to argue when we are stipulating or hypothesizing facts that no one knows to exist. The Time magazine lead, may I say, is not an accurate lead even. The claim that the 140 people are going to be released in within a month, was apparently a misinterpretation, or may have been an exaggerated interpretation of what somebody somewhere said. So I think one of the problems in this whole debate is that people bring to it their presuppositions about the nature of government and the evil of George Bush or whatever, and then just take for granted facts they wish or suppose must exist. In the case of the kids, the guys I know at the Pentagon are deeply, their parents too, and they're deeply cognizant of the tragedy of having anybody who's underage involved in combat. They did ratify the Protocol to the Rights of the Child Convention. And in fact, it's a war crime for the Taliban or for Al-Qaeda to recruit kids who are under the age of 15 under the Rome Treaty for the ICC.
But the argument, Ruth, that's made is that to say that these are minor league age kids playing major leagues with grenades in their hands and to treat them like adults is somehow fighting a type of terrorism with a type of terrorist.
They're not being treated as adults. They're being kept separately. The desire is to get them back in a secure situation as quickly as one can. But if you're going to just put them back in a slum in Karachi to fend as best they can, where they're not going to be kept either safe or kept from the fight, that's not going to be an acceptable situation. The reason why international humanitarian law, with an H, allows the internment of people who've been combatants is that if you simply catch and release, recycle to the battlefield, it's not good for anybody. At the moment, the Taliban are, in fact, very active.
Can I just interrupt you?
Are very active in southeastern Afghanistan. The war is, in every real sense, still going on. You don't want people continuing to fight.
I just want to go back to the point you made about them not being treated as adults, because about the children. The fact is, in international law, you're only supposed to detain children in very limited circumstances. And unless you have a conviction, or unless you have some evidence that it's in the interest of the child, for example, to protect them from harm, you're not allowed to detain them. That, I think, is a very important principle. So it's true that they're being housed separately, though, as the caller pointed out, this only applies to the younger children. But it's still not the case that they are being treated as children are meant to be treated.
1-800-423-8255 for you to join our conversation. Ruth Wedgwood makes the point that the war on terror is still going on. Is that reason enough to treat people in Guantanamo Bay in the manner in which they're being treated? How do you feel about that? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, a conversation about what's going on at Guantanamo Bay. It's one we've had before. We'll have it again because it raises so many questions about the place of this country, the place of this country in the world. 1-800-423-8255. Ruth Wedgwood is with us. She is an advisor to the Department of Defense on the issue of military tribunals in response to the September 11th crisis. She's on leave from her job at Yale Law School, is working as a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Here in the studio with me in Boston, Jacqueline Baba. She is director of Harvard University Committee on Human Rights and a lecturer in that subject at Harvard Law School and at the John F. Kennedy School of Government, was in charge of the Human Rights Program at the University of Chicago. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Danville, Virginia, and Tony's with us. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, I have 2 points. One is, it seems to me, one issue is that there's absolutely no framework that helps us understand the future of these detainees, and spies that are caught, or even traitors, criminals, prisoners of war. There's a kind of a framework that exists for handling those cases. And in these particular situations, we don't know whether these people are going to be held for the rest of their life. We just have no idea, and perhaps they have no idea what their future holds. And it seems that,
Tony, would you be more comfortable if these people were taken before a military tribunal, a U.S. military tribunal, tried, convicted, and then either executed or incarcerated or set free, rather than be in the situation that they're in now?
Well, I certainly think that's one framework that could be used. I would be more comfortable if, in addition to those authorities that are holding them, that there was a second party involved, whether it came from Justice or the State Department, that worked to establish establish a framework, and even if the framework was that these people are going to be held for years and it's going to take time to sort these things through, that they would have some basic rights that may be respected and that there would be some framework. Right now there's absolutely no framework, and that's one of the problems, and that makes us seem totally arbitrary. We have the power over their lives, so we don't have to worry about them. And the other thing that concerns me is I wonder that Guantanamo Bay was specifically identified by the government as a place for detainees so that they were outside the United States proper, because there was a concern that if those detainees were brought here, that certain laws might apply that don't apply to a military base that's outside the United States.
Well, Ruth Wedgwood, there's no debate about that, is there?
Indeed there is. I think one other option would have been Diego Garcia, which was nearer the theater of combat.
But the point that Tony is making is that they're specifically not being held in the United States because then laws of this country wouldn't have to apply?
I don't agree with the causality that's imputed there. I mean, there is a NIMBY problem. There aren't a lot of municipalities that have been volunteering to have 660 al-Qaeda and Taliban held in their facilities nearby, because it would indeed excite attention, and there is some security virtue in having a place that's relatively distant from other...
Surely, if you're not
may suggesting... I finish, please? Other population centers. But I don't agree that's the reason, because look at World War II, where we had 400,000 prisoners of war kept in the continental U.S., and there were not habeas corpus challenges to that, because people presumed that in wartime, and this is a war, the commander-in-chief had the power to intern combatants. But if I could address his major point on frameworks. Number one, I think some of the concerns that people understandably have about an opaque situation should be at least partly mitigated by two commitments the president made. One was given to Sergio Vera de Mello, who was the UN Human Rights High Commissioner shortly before his death in Iraq, in which Bush went on record saying that, of course, the U.S. is committed to never committing torture. And then in supplementary letters from the Department of Defense, the commitment was clarified and extended to say that, of course, anything that was inhumane, degrading, cruel, or unusual was also prohibited pursuant to our treaty ratification of the torture convention. So the sense that this is the gulag, where people are being kept on short rations, factually isn't true, and there's a legal prohibition against it. They are allowed to write to their families.
Let me, if I can, Ruth, go back to the point that Tony brought to the table, and that was just the location of the prison itself.
Yes, if I may just comment on that. I think there's absolutely no doubt that that's the reason why Guantanamo was chosen. There are lots of places, no doubt, where the U.S. government could have housed these detainees, and to suggest that the only reason they're being put in Guantanamo is because nobody wants them in their backyard, I think is virtually laughable. It's quite clear that Guantanamo was used because it seemed to be outside the normal jurisdiction of the U.S. Courts. Now, it may well be that the Supreme Court takes a different view of this, we have to see. But in the meantime, for 2 years, there have been all these people held in a complete legal limbo. And I think this is what Lord Steyn, amongst others, find completely extraordinary, that you hold people in very harsh circumstances beyond the pale of the law. It makes me think of the famous phrase by the social theorist Hannah Arendt, who said that, you know, sometimes people are in such a terrible situation, refugees she was talking about, that it's to their advantage to commit a crime simply so that they get brought into a framework of law. And one feels that if some of these prisoners, for example, killed somebody or did something terrible, at least there would be a legal framework within which they would have their rights or lack of rights adjudicated. So I think this is a very, very serious problem, and I don't think it can just be dismissed by saying, well, there's no one who wants such dangerous people near them, because the U.S. surely has ways of protecting its population from dangerous prisoners.
Is it fair, though, to say that they are being held under such harsh circumstances, your words? Because although they are in small cells, these people, if they have been held over that period of time, are we not given good reason to believe that they're pretty bad people, that they were either working with, associated with, acting as terrorists, and deserve the sort of incarceration that they're getting?
Well, a couple of points, Dick. Firstly, we don't know, because we haven't tested whether they deserve it or not. Some of the people there, 80% of the people there may be guilty, 20% may be innocent. We just don't know, because nobody has had to prove the case. Nobody has had to answer criticisms which have been made that some of these people had really nothing to do with the war. So that's the first point. The second point is that circumstances this must be pretty bad, because we gather that there are many suicide attempts. Now, people don't commit suicide. I mean, it would be extraordinary if there happened to be many depressives there. The fact that there is a considerable suicide rate suggests that things are very bad. Now, they may not be very bad physically. I don't suggest, for example, that people are being starved. But psychologically, I think it is extraordinarily difficult to cope with a situation where you have no idea what your future holds in store. If the prisoners are going to be there for the duration of the war against terrorism, your guess is as good as mine how long that's going to last. Nobody knows.
1-800-423-8255. To Boston now. Jay's joining us. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I'll make my question quick. I'm all for process. I actually like the notion that we might be able to put some in place. However, I'm a little concerned about when do we cross the line between what you might do in a wartime versus what you might do in a court scenario. If we decide to put these people in Guantanamo Bay in front of a court, do we then set a precedent where we have to take everybody that we ever take into custody in a battle in some kind of court in order to adjudicate it? When do we cross the line?
Well, I think that you're quite right to distinguish between the rules of that apply to war and the rules that apply to peace. And we need to be clear here. I think what the international community is saying is that if these people are indeed prisoners of war, then the Geneva Conventions apply. If the Geneva Conventions apply, then they have a right to test their detention before a properly constituted tribunal, a competent tribunal. It's Article 5 of the Geneva Convention. This is what people are saying. Nobody is saying they should just be released. Nobody is saying that they should just face criminal trials if indeed they are prisoners. One's saying, make up your minds. If you're saying that they are criminals, that they are unlawful, then try them in a criminal court. If you're saying that they are prisoners of war, then the Geneva Conventions apply. But there is no third position. The unlawful combatant position is simply not one that the international community has ever recognized, and it's a dangerous precedent.
Dick, if I may, just a couple things. Number one, just on the prior question, they are gaining weight. They have better health care than they've ever gotten in their lives. They're permitted full exercise of their religious rights. Obviously, any situation of internment is depressing, and one is concerned about suicide attempts. But to suggest that they're being physically mistreated is, I think, unfounded and... until there is some evidence, I just find it a kind of histrionic criticism.
I don't think Jacqueline said that they were being physically mistreated.
I think there was an implication.
I said that we don't know. Nobody's saying that.
Harsh circumstances.
Well, I think if you face indefinite detention and you are suicidal, that is harsh circumstances by my definition.
The problem with the legal framework, if you want my prediction of what will happen eventually, there will be continued attempts to collect intelligence. A certain number of people will be repatriated to their countries, either for internment there or for release or for prosecution there. A certain number will be put on trial before the military commissions, held to the very high standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. These are going to be difficult cases to bring. They're going to have lots of gray mail problems, just like Moussaoui. They're not going to be easy slam dunk cases. And I think eventually, when there is a sense of some understanding of who the people are, there will be something that's more like a mental health hearing in which, at a periodic interval, you'll ask, is the war over for this person? Is he no longer dangerous? If we release him, will he continue to pose a threat? Because nobody wants to hold people gratuitously.
Everybody
has human rights, whether they're combatants or not.
Ruth, how can you ever predict whether the war is going to be over for somebody? How can you ever predict that?
The problem with this war is that there's no government that can demobilize the terrorists. Even bin Laden probably can't demobilize what he set in motion. So the only question you can ask is this person still dangerous? They do it in the case of certain kinds of mental health proceedings. They do it when I may not like it, but in the case of certain kinds of supposed sexual predators. It's the only question you could ask responsibly when you release somebody.
Do you think, Ruth, that 20 years from now, people will be talking about the Guantanamo Conventions, new international law, which is based on what's going on in Cuba now?
Well, your original idea was the right one. In fact, the historian of the ICRC has made the same remark to me, that typically you codify things after the fact. And I guess where I object to the imputation that this is intended to be lawless or a black hole or free spaces, I mean, U.S. folks, including uniform guys, are acutely aware that what goes around comes around, and therefore that the regime that one is helping to create legally, adapting Geneva principles to new facts, ought to be one that's sustainable, that will over time gain acceptance and understanding. But I think it's in part in international law, one of the troubles is that there's no easy way to amend things. So you're often stuck with textual law from the last war that may not fit the changed facts of people. Geneva, for example, says you can't put people in any size cell. That would mean you'd have to let al-Qaeda roam around the camp.
But I think, Jacqueline, that one of the reasons why this subject always raises people's blood pressure is simply because there is an expectation of a certain standard of justice and fairness and principles that the United States exercises, that the United States expects its own people will be treated by. I mean, that's in part why it becomes such a hot-button topic.
I quite agree. I think it is precisely because people expect the U.S. to behave in a lawful manner and not to flout international law, not to completely disregard virtually unanimous international criticism. I mean, it is extraordinary if you look at it. The Australians, the British, the French, the Spanish, there isn't hardly a single, judiciary or high-standing legal authority outside the U.S. that has come out in support of this. Now, it could hardly be the case that the U.S. Interpretation is so far from the correct one that everybody else is getting it wrong. It seems to me an extraordinary situation. So what I would say is that certainly the current situation with the war on terrorism calls for rethinking of many of the principles that we've had. But in the meantime, we cannot proceed in a lawless manner, denying people a right to a hearing and denying them access to a lawyer. Surely that's a basic principle which will hold whatever new laws we come up with.
Ruth, quick last one from you.
Two quick things. Number one, Australian Prime Minister John Howard just said that he is fully confident that the trial rules for the military commissions for war crimes trials are fair and that Australian defendants can be put before them. Number two, even under the Geneva Convention's Article 5 hearings, so to say, which are only one time when you're taken on the battlefield, never have had lawyers. Those are determinations by the detaining power that does the capture. It's the law of armed conflict, international humanitarian law. It's not quite the same as peacetime law, even if the aspirations are the same.
Well, I don't want to get into a technical legal discussion, but that's not what I have Article 5 in front of me, and that's not what it
there
says.
Are no
and
there's no.
They're not excluded either. And the fact of the matter is that these detainees have had 2 years without access to any lawyer whatsoever.
Ruth Wedgwood, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
With your gold, Ruth Wedgwood, Professor of International Law at Johns Hopkins School of International Studies in Washington, D.C. Jacqueline Baba, thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
Jacqueline is human rights professor at both Harvard's John F. Kennedy School and Harvard Law School. Earlier in the program, we heard from Vivica Novak, a correspondent with Time magazine, who traveled recently to Guantanamo Bay. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.